This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a podcast I've been very much looking forward to because today we're going to interview someone who I really consider a very balanced voice in the diet debate. He has written a great new book called The Hungry Brain. It's just out. The Hungry Brain, Outsmarting the Instincts That Make Us Overeat. He's Dr. Stéphane Guyenet, that's spelled G-U-Y-E-N-E-T, in case you want to look it up. He's a PhD, a neuroscientist, and an obesity researcher and health writer, who does a wonderful blog at his website, Whole Health Source, wholehealthsource.org, or StéphaneGuyenet.com, right? There's a couple of ways to get there. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
And he's frequently addresses issues related to obesity, metabolism, and nutrition. And so today we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion about diet and what drives us to overeat and, I guess, be overly sedentary and end up with an epidemic of obesity in this country and across the world. So, Dr. Guyenet, why is this book different from all other books about weight loss? There's a whole lot of books about this and lots of theories, and they come out at regular intervals. What different perspective are you bringing to this issue?
Yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me on the show. I think the essential thing to realize to understand about my book and understand what's important about my book is to realize that all behavior, including eating, including what we select to eat and how much of it we eat, is generated by the brain. And so what my book does is it takes a look at the brain circuits that cause us to eat impulsively and eat instinctively in terms of our cravings and our appetite and other sort of non-conscious brain processes that drive us to eat more than we want to eat. Because nobody actually wants to overeat, yet most of us do, and most of us gain weight over time as a consequence of that. And so what are those circuits that cause us to do that? I'm not aware of any other general audience book that has taken a brain-centric approach to answering this question. So there are a lot of other books that have looked at diet and lifestyle and other things that are known to impact eating behavior and body weight, but none of them have really looked at it from the perspective of the brain, which, as I've explained, is the organ that generates those behaviors. So I do want to clarify a little bit, just so the audience understands, it's not really a diet book. I do offer some guidance on ways to manage weight more effectively that are based on this understanding of the brain systems that underlie eating behavior. But it's more of a descriptive book than it is a prescriptive book.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that that's important because when we, you know, it's just like psychology or psychiatry, when we develop an insight into what drives us, we can sometimes get on top of those impulses that lead us astray, and it enables us to make better decisions based on an understanding of our innate brain chemistry or physiology.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And the thing that I really hope for this book, I hope that people will read it and they will really recognize themselves in it and say, oh, wow, this really explains my behavior in these situations when I'm placed around tempting food or when I eat something and I don't feel full as I think I should. This really explains why I'm driven to eat more calories than I want to eat, even though I know it's not good for me.
Mm-hmm. And so you start the book by looking at various hunter-gatherer tribes, a little side trip into anthropology, where, you know, we look at ancient people in pristine environments. And what does that tell us about, you know, how we're wired in terms of our neurochemistry that impels us to have a hungry brain?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question because evolution crafts organisms that are good at surviving and reproducing. Reproductive success is the currency of natural selection. And so it makes sense that whatever an animal can evolve to allow itself to survive better and reproduce better is going to be favored by natural selection. So when we look at humans in our natural environment or any species, acquiring food efficiently is one of the most important targets of selection because it's so important for reproduction and survival. And so the human brain has been honed over millions of years of natural selection to have certain criteria that it's looking for out of food and out of the food environment. And so, for example, if we look at hunter-gatherer cultures, and this can be done in a variety of species, but it's been shown to apply to hunter-gatherers as well, and you say, how do they make food-related decisions? How do they decide which foods to pursue and which foods not to pursue? And what is it fundamentally that the human brain is looking for out of food? And you can actually model this mathematically, and it's surprisingly simple to predict what foods hunter-gatherers are going to pursue using an equation that comes from a discipline called optimal foraging theory. And basically, if you model hunter-gatherer behavior, what you see is that their food choice is dictated by this equation that says the value of a food is equal to the number of calories that food supplies minus the number of calories it takes to obtain and prepare it divided by time. And so that's the free return rate is what that equation describes. And this is a very basic type of economic equation that's used in a variety of different contexts to maximize the return of whatever it is, money or calories or whatever.
Well, that would suggest
so
that if
we've been crafted that
would,
by
that would suggest if they opened up a Pizza Hut or you know, a 7-Eleven in the Kalahari Desert, that would be the place that those hunter gatherers would rapidly gravitate towards.
Hunter gatherers would love pizza. I mean, pizza because of the wiring of the brain, pizza is the ultimate score. I mean, it's very calorie dense. The brain is, so I'll just finish what I was saying.
Sure.
Here real quick, and then I'll move in to address what you were saying.
Yep.
But basically what the point I'm trying to make here is that the human brain is very preoccupied with calories. So overall, we're very preoccupied with calories. Our behavior gravitates toward obtaining calories as efficiently as possible. That's how our impulses are wired. And we have some control over that, but that's how our impulses are wired. And how does that express itself? So it expresses itself in a hardwired attraction for specific food properties that deliver calories, like sugar and carbohydrate and fat and starch and protein. And so these are food properties that drive our motivation. So the more concentrated they are, the more it spikes dopamine in our brains. Literally, those things are detected in our gastrointestinal system, including the mouth and the small intestine and the stomach. Those signals go up to your brain, and your brain says, how good was this food based on how much of those properties were there? And if you have a high concentration of those things indicating a lot of calories, your brain says, wow, this was amazing. Dopamine starts to spike, And that triggers your motivation and learning to repeat that behavior. And so pizza is a very concentrated source of fat and starch and salt and to a lesser extent protein. But basically, when your brain starts getting wind of all those concentrated nutrients that are in the pizza, it starts going crazy and it drives your motivation to keep eating. Particularly, it drives your motivation to seek pizza the next time you smell that smell or you see the sight of the box or the pizza or the place where you were. And so, absolutely, hunter-gatherers would go crazy for pizza or candy or brownies or cake. I mean, that has all the things in it that the human brain is instinctively looking for.
So that kind of harkens back to a paper written, I guess it was in the 80s, Stone Agers in the Fast Lane, by Mel Konner and Boyd Eaton, that we are still Stone Agers from an evolutionary standpoint. Our genes haven't changed that much because clearly this predilection for calories is maladaptive from an evolutionary standpoint because we're now seeing mortality statistics go in reverse in this country due to poor eating habits, diseases that are degenerative like heart disease, stroke, and cancer. So, we're equipped with the genes of that may be appropriate to the savanna of, 50,000 or 100,000 years ago, and it's not working out well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is something that people call an evolutionary mismatch. And I think that paper by Eaton and Konner you cited is one of the earlier examples of people really starting to think about this systematically. And it has incredible consequences. I mean, evolutionary mismatches, I think overeating is probably one of the most damaging instances you could think of. But I mean, there are many other examples throughout our lives, like debt, financial debt. I mean, yep. The human brain is not really set up to think about abstract concepts like money and extrapolate into decades in the future, So, I mean, I think there are a lot of things like this where the brain, we can think about these things using the rational, logical tools of our brain, and we can come to rational conclusions about debt or eating or whatever, but we still have these impulses that are often going to push us in the right direction. And I think that's a sign that our brains fundamentally are not really that well suited to certain aspects of modern life. And yeah, it does absolutely tremendous damage to us. And I think this is very easy to see because to eat a healthy diet in the modern United States or in other affluent nations, to eat a really healthy diet, you have to swim upstream.
Yes, precisely.
You cannot just go with your basest impulses and you cannot just go with what everyone else in society is doing. You kind of, to an extent, you kind of have to fight yourself. You have to fight your own impulses to an extent to avoid these severe consequences that a lot of people are experiencing in our culture. And so I think the fact that our conscious rational minds and our impulsive brain circuits are not aligned, that they're in conflict with one another, is I think a really good indication that our brain circuitry is not really adapted to the world that we live in.
Well, let's drill down on that brain circuitry. It's very complex, but you lay it out respect to the complexity of it, you lay it out in a very comprehensible way in the book. But let's start with something that's in the popular lexicon these days, leptin. Leptin is a big buzzword in the study of obesity. And so explain how that interplays with our appetite and with our susceptibility to gain weight, and is there a way to get that under control?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that you feel that it's that public consciousness of leptin is increasing, because I think it's a very, very important hormone and a very, very important mechanism. And I think that if we want to understand body weight and we want to understand weight loss and weight regain, we have to understand leptin, because it is the hormone that's central to those processes. So basically the way it works is that the brain regulates body fatness. We have evidence going back to the late 1800s that the brain is intimately involved in the control of body fatness. And the way that works is that fat tissue secretes a hormone called leptin. That leptin is secreted in proportion to the size of your fat mass, and it circulates in your blood as a marker of the amount of fat that you have. That is received by your brain, and especially a part of your brain called the hypothalamus, but also some other parts. And the hypothalamus hears that and uses it to regulate the things that control your body fatness, like appetite and your calorie expenditure. Mm-hmm. And so basically
it should be a feedback mechanism. It's kind of like a thermostat. If leptin goes up, the thought is that should tune down your appetite and your food seeking behaviors.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. So the name for it, the technical name is a negative feedback system. And as you said, it's just like your thermostat. So with your thermostat, you set your temperature to a certain set point. So you would set it to, let's say, 65 degrees. And then if the temperature goes below that, you have heat that kicks in that brings it back up. The temperature goes above that, you have air conditioning that kicks in to bring it back down. That's called a negative feedback system, and it's designed to maintain stability of something like temperature that you want to keep stable. And so the brain regulates temperature in that way too. It measures your body temperature, and then it takes actions to increase or decrease your core temperature as necessary. And it's very, very good at maintaining a very precise body temperature, no matter what the exterior temperature is. And so body fatness is another thing the brain regulates. And I want to specify that this leptin system seems to work a lot better at preventing weight loss than it does at preventing weight gain.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people can attest to that.
From an evolutionary standpoint, we can understand that, because you know, when you deal with the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, very few of them are dying of obesity related causes. I mean, there's little need in free living conditions for hunter gatherers to have evolved a weight control mechanism that doesn't favor weight maintenance or maybe storing some additional fat against a future famine.
Yeah, that's right. I think that most of human existence until relatively recently has been a struggle to get enough calories to maintain weight and to be, you know, remain alive and fertile. And it's only really recently that the challenge of excess calories has eclipsed the challenge of insufficient calories, at least in a lot of places, as the primary challenge. And so I think, you know, we do have some mechanisms that protect against excess fat accumulation, and those vary quite a bit between people. So some people are a lot better. Some people's brains and bodies are much better at preventing overeating or burning off excess calories than others. Some people will just take all the excess calories they eat, put it right into fat tissue. Other people will just burn it right off. And I'm not talking about by going jogging. I'm talking about their physiology will just burn it off. Mm. So there are mechanisms that act in the other direction, preventing weight gain, but they're not nearly as powerful. They vary quite a bit between people, and they don't necessarily involve leptin specifically.
Well, leptin was once thought to be the holy grail of pharmaceutical drug development, because they thought if they could just take leptin and inject people with leptin, that'd make them maintain weight or lose weight. It's the magic, you know, fat melting substance. But where do they go wrong with that?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting story, because when leptin was first identified, it was rightly thought of as kind of the fat hormone, which is what we know it to be today, playing a very key role in regulating body fatness. And animals, and including humans, that lack leptin are enormously obese and have massive appetites. They're totally insatiable. You can't really diet down an animal or a human that doesn't have leptin. Their bodies and their minds just fight it so hard. A leptin deficient mouse will literally die before it becomes lean. Like, if you try to starve it lean, it will literally die first. So it's a very powerful hormone in terms of weight regulation. But the thing about it is, it, like I was saying, it mostly acts to prevent weight loss. And so if you don't have it, it, or if the level goes down because you're losing weight, that sends a starvation signal to your brain, and especially your hypothalamus. And it says, just like your thermostat, if the temperature goes down to 60, it kicks in the heat. Well, in your hypothalamus, if leptin drops, it starts to kick in your appetite and your food motivation. It starts to reduce your calorie expenditure. You feel cold and sluggish. And it does all those things to try to bring the fat back into your fat tissue. But the problem is that when you have extra leptin, when you put a bunch of extra leptin in, it doesn't really trigger a response in the other direction. It doesn't make you, your brain doesn't say, hold on there, we've got way too much fat, we got to do something about this, and then cut down your appetite. So it works in some contexts in rodents, but in humans it doesn't really quite work like that. So it turned out that leptin was not the kind of home run obesity drug that the pharmaceutical industry was hoping for.
So recently you wrote a blog on the subject of The Biggest Loser. Researcher Kevin Hall went back and looked at the records of some of the contestants. This is 6 years after, I guess it was season 8. And they found some pretty disturbing things. They found that there was 13 of 14 contestants had regained all their weight. And some pretty scary things happened to their physiology, suggesting that, you know, maybe they're giving us kind of a fatalistic view about the prospects for long-term weight loss.
Yeah, so, you know, this leptin system that I've been talking about that resists weight loss, basically it's like a spring. If you stretch it just a little bit, it gives you a little bit of resistance, and the more you stretch it, the more resistance it gives you, so the harder it pushes back. So it would be kind of like your thermostat. If it's set to 65 and it goes down to 64, let's imagine that it would just kick in the heat just a little bit. But if it found that the temperature was 45, it would kick in the heat a lot. You know, it would give you a really strong response. So that's kind of like what happens with this starvation response in the brain. So people on The Biggest Loser are losing enormous amounts of weight. I mean, these people are frequently losing over 100 pounds of body weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so
one contestant, I think he lost 295 pounds. He was the champion contestant at 191 pounds. He looked svelte, and now he's back up again.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, that amount of weight loss is incredible. And I mean, the amount of willpower that must take is just stunning. But yeah, they tend to regain the weight, and they, especially when they're at a reduced weight, there is a lot of evidence from The Biggest Loser and from other studies that you get this very powerful physiological response when someone is substantially weight reduced. And so the thing that study you referenced was focusing on, the study by Kevin Hall, is energy expenditure. So basically the number of calories that their body is burning, both at rest and especially during physical activity, is greatly reduced. And so that's part of that brain program that your hypothalamus kicks in when leptin goes down that allows it to try to get that fat back. So it's a very, very powerful starvation response that's similar to what you would see in someone who doesn't have any leptin.
And the weight comes roaring back. So clearly that's not the most expeditious way to curb our epidemic of obesity. Massive, rapid, draconian weight loss under circumstances of extremely restricted diet and very intense exercise don't do the trick, according to the research on The Biggest Loser. And, you know, the practical example, a lot of people pretty disillusioned with that process, the contestants themselves. Okay, we've laid the groundwork for our discussion of The Hungry Brain. The book, The Hungry Brain, Outsmarting the Instincts That Make Us Overeat. With us today, the author, Stéphane Guillenet. He's a PhD neuroscientist, and he lays out the complex biochemistry and neurochemistry that are propelling us to ever-increasing obesity in this country. But in part two, we're going to focus on some potential solutions, some ways to outsmart our hungry brain, because with some insight and understanding comes a modus operandi to help us overcome overweight. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back with part two. Stay with us. This is Intelligent Medicine.